Mr. Bevis, reel 4.
When you joined, actually, like that, you said that this was quite rife in the barracks, this backhanding.
Yes,
was
I was going found out after, although I never came up against any more of them, not in my particular line, but my next-door neighbour, who was a seaman, he told me that it would cost him a fortune to go in the barracks. Told me he'd mustered his kit and something was missing, so you gave the clothing chap a tip, and you wanted the weekend ashore, you had to tip somebody else to get the weekend ashore, and all sorts of things you had to tip to.
And there was also, I think, quite a bit of gambling, and this also involved backhanding at that time, you said to me. Just
crown and anchor, that was rife everywhere. But in the ships I used to go in the heads, forehead, pay a man Jim Crow up top, watch for the police. And that went on. But eventually it was stamped right out. I mean, you came through Charlotte, through Queen Street, and every shop there was selling crown and anchor boards all hung up. You just went in and bought them, and the dice. But I never got implicated in. I'm not a gambling man in any case.
Would the police actually, they could be bribed off as well? I mean, gambling was forbidden technically in the Navy, but I think you were saying that you could even backhand the policeman, the ship's policeman, the ship's corporal.
I think they were, they must have been in it, but I think their perk was to raid the place and take all the money that was on the board. That was there. That's why they had the Jim Crow there. In fact, in these London docks, when I was up there during the war, you know, they used to play pitch and toss there. And there was huge amounts on these cargo hatches in the dinner hours. You know, pounds, not pence.
Yeah.
And, of course, they got the police in there to break that up. Because the dinner hours then started at an hour and were going all the afternoon once they got in these.
Thing though, I think in the old, you know, in your time.
Yeah, that was, I should imagine, the mecca of the.
You did say too that which I thought was quite amusing, that the drafting business could also be set up here too, that it was arranged in local pubs.
Yeah.
Can you tell me something about how this would work?
Well, of course, I knew that. The public houses existed where the chief stoker, the regulating chief stoker, he was the boy, the regulating head of the stokers or seamen come to that. And you could go down there and lash them up for some free beer and say you'd like to go to China, and they'd do what they. An amusing tale I know was coming home from China, where the chief stoker was travelling second class, but the stoker PO was steerage, and every night they used to get on the dividing line on the upper deck and talk across the line. And this is a Chatham man, and every night he ended up and said, "Now to be the senior chief stoker in the Chatham division. And when you come back off leave, you come and see me, you'll be all right." Every night from China was the same good night. Well, they had different leaves, because one had been up the river. You only do 2 years up the river, and you've done 2.5 years if you were in a boat that wasn't up the river. So they had different leaves. Anyway, this stoker PO was telling me he came back, thought, right, pokes his head through the little hitch in the drafting office. Right, Chief. Oh, yeah, so-and-so. He said, he hands me a chit. He said, do you know what was on it? I said, no. He said, HMS Benbow, the only coal-burning blasted ship there is in the Navy. So he said, I'll put my head back. I said, don't you do any more white ratting for me.
Going on, that's kind of like when shipwrights like yourself joined. Now you know done your basic, you joined the Navy. They did, I think, at that time as leading hands for your probationary year. Tell me this problem about the rate of the chief of the shipwright and how this affected yourself. How they weren't given their status in the Navy at that time.
You're poor. You had the constructive, you had the engineering, and you had the electrical. In the engineering, you had fitters, turners, blacksmiths, pedlers. The electrical people had their fitters. All those joined, and they would be given a chief's rate. Yet the poor old shipwright, all he could get was a first class rate. So of course you couldn't get any to join. And therefore the inception of this by the what's name to defeat the trade unions who kept on at the Admiralty to bring us up in line with the remainder of the mechanics in there. Which ended up, of course, with the Gerham report, and we were all brought in line. We're all the same now.
How did it affect yourself when you joined, this question? How did it affect your own money and position? You were brought in 1918.
Yeah, I'm 4 and threepence a day. Which I had to go a 12 month. And then when this was implemented and we got the chief's rate, the rate went to 9 and sixpence. Which was quite a good wage in those days. But it remained at 9 and sixpence for the whole of my career. Except I got the increments as I got the different steps up. But that was only in sixpences a day. And of course then come to 1930, when I got to the top, the Geddes Act came in, or the MacDonald government, when the mutiny was at Scapa Flow, when they docked us a shilling a day, and I was almost back to where I started. Which, looking through that, reminded me of the trip on the Vindictive. When I commissioned the Cornflower, they decided the Vindictive had been refitting at Chatham. And they decided to make her into a trooper. And they put two sloops crews aboard there. That was us and the Bridgewater. And all the other odd replacements for different ships in the China fleet. Well, when you imagine there's 90 in the crew of a sloop. So that was 180. There must have been 200 men poked into a sloop. That I suppose her normal complement was somewhere about 400. The consequence was the galleys couldn't cope with the extra. The messing was only built for, say, 4 men, and they put 6 men in. Put 8 men in there. Cool, the chief's mess. Almost had to have 2 sittings for your meals. And we got to Suez, and the Resolution was there with all guns gleaming. She sent us a signal, congratulations on our yacht-like appearance, but we didn't get any news when we got to Suez. Well, everybody was cursing the wireless bloke who they said, oh, he's been amiss the news. At any rate, we got in the Suez Canal, we went through the Suez. There was another battleship at the other end, And then we got the news, and it was this reduction of pay. That's how they got us through the Suez Canal. And the food, apparently, they'd been fiddling the stores around in Chatham. They didn't have it in the ship, and they couldn't. They had it in the ship in the books. Do you know, we sat down for supper one night with a huge plate with two sardines on it. Two sardines on a pretty great plate. And I was sitting next to the chief stoker. I'll never forget it. He said, do they reckon I'm going to keep the middle watch on that? And he picked this plate up, and he managed to find the steward. And he came back with a big plate of ham. So we all rushed out, but we never found the steward from that day to this. And of course, it was people there going out. It would have been different coming home, but going away, they were all throwing their hands in and said the Admiralty had broke contract. They contracted for 12 years at a certain rate of pay, and they were being docked. But anyway, we got out there. Then on top of that, the captain became ill, and it was, well, we met a merchant ship, big merchant ship, said that with the captain said it was the hottest journey he'd done in 20 years on the run. Well, they turned the Vindictive round when this captain became so ill to try and get wind. And what they done, they took an armchair up on the bridge and all the electric fans from down below to play on him. So there was us stifling down below with no fans, all playing on this skipper. He came home, but he died when he got home. God, what a trip. Luckily, we came home in a proper trooper.
Quite interesting.
With everybody not only growling about the loss of pay, but the conditions we were sailing out under.
But there was no real threat?
No, there was no mutiny like there was up at Scapa.
Before we leave the question, actually, of your own probation year, just on this question, which we started on, some people never quite made it, even that, as late as that. Some people failed to complete, or the Navy didn't want them. I mean, it wasn't automatic that you
no.
would be accepted.
You had to be recommended. And if you weren't recommended, you had to do another 12 months. And if you didn't do it then, you were thrown out of the Navy.
And some people, of course...
I only know of one.
Mm. What, in fact, for what reason? Was it a work reason, or was it other reason that he failed to be accepted? Or was it his personality,
work,
or his
work? He didn't have any interest. He sort of got in the Navy and then found he didn't like it, and he done everything to make himself objectionable.
And there were others, I think you said, who just conned their way through it as well, who weren't really very good tradesmen.
No, well, of course you get that everywhere, don't you?
But you'd have to carry them in certain cases.
Yes. Yes, we had some that were just born drunks. As far as they got in the harbour, going to get sozzled up with drink, then they weren't much use for 2 or 3 days. But they were the exception, I suppose, rather than the rule.
But there was the other question about shipwrights that you raised, a good point, that when you went to the Royal Sovereign, there were only two of you who were proper shipwrights.
Yes.
Who had done the training. The rest...
Two and myself.
Yeah. Tell me about the situation and how this led up to some tension and how it worked out eventually.
Well, they simply regarded us as interlopers. And we couldn't get any cooperation. All the worst jobs were doled out.
Such as?
Well, all the jobs in the weather in the winter time in Scotland was one good example. Anything on the upper deck was ours, whilst they were down below in the warm. And so we eventually overcame it. One example, I suppose, was when I joined there, they said to me, the boss, he couldn't do the paperwork on these stores. I don't know that he couldn't do it. He didn't want to do it. And he would always get the youngest one in his office to do that. Well, of course, I didn't know anything. But they said to him, if he asks you, don't do it. Then I went after a lap up on the upper deck freezing. I thought myself, if he asked me, I'm the first one in his office, which I was. And I really had a good time then because I couldn't get there till 9 o'clock of the morning. And I was always well dressed and only had this scribbling to do. And I really had an easy time under him. So I did gain out of there.
But you also found out that they had been logging.